morning.
Well, if you look at your material from before the conference and you thought, wait a minute, I thought there was a different name. Kevin Terrio was initially slated to do this presentation, but I'm what you call a game day substitution. But I am really happy to be with you all. I was actually born in Missouri, so this was a nice chance to come back. We're going to talk today about protecting your pregnancy center. As you all know, pregnancy centers are motivated by shared beliefs regarding the sacredness of life and that abortion is one of society's greatest tragedies. But in a society where the freedom to peacefully work, live, and act according to one's sincerely held religious beliefs is constantly under attack, pregnancy centers are being targeted by pro-abortion organizations and activists. Everyone here knows that pregnancy centers are often targeted by these organizations and activists who object to the life-affirming services that you provide to pregnant women and their unborn children. In fact, in many states, they and their allies in state and local governments have launched legislative campaigns to compel pregnancy centers to talk about abortion in some way or to regulate the way you interact with your clients. These efforts are aimed at hurting pregnancy centers by making them speak what they do not believe and by making them act in ways that are in conflict with the very reason for their being. If this weren't enough, we live in a society of woke ideology, for lack of a better word, that is continually pushing for acceptance and celebration of ideas that religious Christians and pro-life pregnancy centers cannot support because of our deeply held beliefs. They push legislation to support these ideas and to make those who might disagree support those ideas. Thankfully, the United States Constitution exists to protect your ability to operate in accordance with your beliefs about abortion and the sanctity of life. And I'm here today to help you make sure that your center is well protected by these powerful rights. This session is aimed at providing your pregnancy centers and their boards with the knowledge necessary to enable them to operate consistent with your religious and pro-life beliefs. A frequent question among pregnancy centers, which generally have some sort of religious background, is whether it is preferable to organize and operate as a religious organization or be a more generic nonprofit. Even when a center chooses to operate as a religious organization, more issues can arise. How religious do we have to be? How do we describe ourselves to the outside world, to our clients? What types of behaviors, beliefs, and moral standards do we want our employees and volunteers to have? Do we want to maintain a public affiliation with a church or religious group? This session will seek to give you the tools to answer those questions for yourselves. And today we're going to look at, what are your constitutional rights? So just, I'm going to give you a basic overview of your rights. What are the threats? And I'm sure you guys are more than well aware of what those threats are. What are the laws that protect you at the state, local, and federal level? What laws apply to your centers and may provide you with some protection? And finally, giving you practical tips on how to legally protect your center as an organization that expresses certain pro-life beliefs and values. Much of what I'm going to talk to you about is available in ADF's guide, Protecting Your Pregnancy Center. And you can go to that website and download it. If you want to get actually hard copies, you can contact ADF and we will send them to you. So I'll give you a chance to write that down. And in addition to what I'm going to talk about today, there's some more samples of policy statements and other things available in that resource that I won't be able to really go over in this sort of environment today. Did everybody get a chance to jot that down or take a picture? Okay. The First Amendment grants all of us a right to freedom of speech. But what does that mean exactly? The First Amendment restricts the government from being able to forbid people from expressing their views. The intention of the First Amendment is to protect all views. But what I like to remember, there's a couple of things I like to remember about the First Amendment, is it's not necessarily designed to protect majority opinion, which needs no protection because it's held by the majority, but was designed to protect minority opinions. And it's also designed to protect speech that might upset or offend some people. Because if speech didn't offend or perhaps challenge people, we wouldn't need the First Amendment, right? If everybody disagreed, it was okay what you were saying, we wouldn't have to worry about having protections in place for people's rights to express their views. The marketplace of ideas underlines the First Amendment, and it allows ideas to be expressed, to be debated, to be accepted, and to be rejected. In a case that upheld the ability of someone to burn the American flag as a matter of freedom of speech, the Supreme Court famously said, "If there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds that idea offensive or disagreeable." But what is protected is not always, what type of speech is protected is not always as straightforward as we would like it to be. What is important to remember is that the First Amendment restricts the ability of the government to shut down your speech or to censor your speech. Private individuals, organizations, social media companies, and others aren't subject to the First Amendment because they're not the government. Now, there is an evolving doctrine that's coming out where they talk about quasi-government actors or common carriers like cable networks being held to the First Amendment. And there's certainly a possibility, we believe, that social media networks will be next to be able to be subject to First Amendment restrictions on what they can do in terms of censoring speech. We obviously haven't gotten there yet, but it is certainly a distinct possibility. The First Amendment applies to both the federal government and to state and local governments through the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. The right to freedom of speech as we know it today did not exist until about 50 years ago when the Supreme Court began issuing a variety of decisions about what types of speech is protected. And you also need to remember many state constitutions separately protect First Amendment freedoms. Like they have basically taken the First Amendment and put it into their state constitutions. Another important thing to remember about the First Amendment is that it treats most harshly the government's lack of equal protection, equal treatment of speech. It prohibits what's called content and viewpoint-based discrimination, unless the government can meet a very high standard. You may have heard the term strict scrutiny, if you've ever seen them talking about different legal cases that come out of the court. That's an incredibly high standard to meet, to actually curtail somebody's speech. Content restrictions occur when an entire topic is forbidden. Like, okay, you can't talk about abortion. That would be a content restriction. And a viewpoint restriction is when a view on a topic is targeted. So you can't engage in pro-life speech, but if you want to support abortion, we'll allow you to speak. That's viewpoint discrimination. So content discrimination is much more broad. Viewpoint discrimination is going to be targeted against what might be a minority or an unpopular or a controversial viewpoint.
Okay, do that again.
Content would be the broad, meaning you can't talk about abortion regardless of what side you're on. We're just not going to talk about the issue of abortion. That's content discrimination. Viewpoint discrimination is when you target a specific viewpoint on abortion, for example. Like, you can't engage in pro-life speech, but will allow you to speak if you support abortion. So that's censoring only one particular viewpoint, not the entire topic. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, these types of speech restrictions, as you can imagine, are very relevant to many of the restrictions pro-life organizations and individuals have faced in recent years. And again, the Supreme Court has said, but above all else, the First Amendment means that the government has no power to restrict expression because of its message, its ideas, its subject matter, or its content. And how many of you guys have heard of the case NIFLA versus Becerra, in which ADF challenged a California regulation on pregnancy centers that required them to post signs and give information about that the state would pay for abortions and birth control. Luckily, we won that case at the Supreme Court. And in that case, the Supreme Court wisely said the people lose when the government decides which ideas are going to prevail. The right to freedom of speech is uniquely American. There is no other country in the world that protects free speech to the extent that we do. And that right needs to be cherished and protected. The First Amendment not only protects your right to speak, but the component right not to speak. And that was what was at issue in NIFLA versus Becerra, the right for pregnancy centers not to provide information on abortion and birth control. Under the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment, it is incredibly difficult for the government to force a person or organization to refer or provide information on abortion, birth control, and other services to which that person objects. You're going to hear me quoting the Supreme Court a lot here because it's important to remember that the court has gone to great lengths, both liberal justices and conservative justices, to protect free speech. And the court said about 70 years ago, if there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what will be orthodox in matters of politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word their faith therein, which means the government can't tell you what to say and what to express in the public square. This is what we attorneys call compelled speech, meaning you're being compelled to express a message that you disagree with and you wouldn't, of your own volition, speak. Compelled speech laws are a type of law commonly being used or considered to restrict the activity of pregnancy centers. They, at times, try to force you to make a certain statement, as they did in California, to say you have to put, or they tried to do in California, we put a stop to that, but put up a sign that says, you know, here's where you can get information about abortion and birth control. To tell them, you know, we are not a, another part of the case was to say we're not a licensed medical clinic, basically as soon as the person walked in the door. So there were two types of speech that the government was trying to force the pregnancy centers to engage in. And it doesn't matter whether the content of the required speech is true or not. What matters is the government cannot force you to engage in speech that you don't want to. So even if what California was trying to have them say was true, you can get free information, you can get access to abortion and birth control through these providers or through this website, that didn't matter. It was that they were trying to force the pregnancy centers to give that information against their deeply held beliefs and in violation of their freedom of speech. So you're going to get a mini law class, even more of a mini law class. I'm going to try and condense down what for me was a year's worth of law school. When you take a First Amendment course in law school, it's, as you can imagine, a very in-depth study. But ideological speech is subject to the greatest protection when it's infringed. And what I mean by ideological speech is what you believe, what your most cherished beliefs are, what you believe about abortion, that would qualify as ideological speech. So your speech related to abortion, obviously. Commercial speech, however, is subject to less protection. And what commercial speech is generally thought of is solely related to the economic interest of the speaker or their audience. So it's not your deeply held beliefs, it's speech to promote your economic interests. Commercial speech does no more than propose a commercial transaction. So the Supreme Court has something called commercial speech doctrine that generally applies to advertisements for goods and services. Because the public has no interest in getting false or misleading commercial speech, such speech is not protected. Commercial speech is held to a lesser standard of scrutiny when it's restricted, and the government need only show an important interest for putting those restrictions in place. So it's a much lower bar when you're talking about advertisements and things that are put out into the stream of commerce. Most courts have rejected the application of this commercial speech doctrine to compelled speech laws affecting pregnancy centers. So, I mean, and a lot of pregnancy centers obviously are advertising. They're out in the marketplace. But the message you're conveying is based on your most deeply held religious beliefs and your beliefs about what life means. So in that way, it is ideological speech, not commercial speech. And as we talked about, ideological speech is subject to much greater protections than commercial speech. And the courts have found that pregnancy centers are not engaged in speech for financial gain, but instead are furthering your views on pregnancy, childbirth, adoption, abortion. So when you're speaking in the public square, you're furthering your viewpoint, you're furthering your deeply held beliefs. You're not engaging in speech for financial gain. Professional speech. This is kind of a newly emerging doctrine within free speech. And this category is essentially speech by professionals, usually licensed professionals, doctors, lawyers. People that the state grant a license to practice within their borders. It makes it much easier to restrict the speech of these professionals if what they're talking about is within the scope of their practice. So as a lawyer, I'm a Texas attorney. So the state of Texas may be able to limit my speech or regulate my speech when it's dealing with my practice of law in certain circumstances, but it can't more broadly regulate my ability to speak in other contexts, like when I come to things like this. The Supreme Court has not recognized this doctrine, and it expressly declined to do so towards pregnancy centers in NIFLA versus Becerra. Because one of the arguments the state of California was making is that medical pregnancy centers had doctors or other licensed medical professionals working within the center, and therefore the state of California had an interest in regulating the speech of those individuals. But again, the court said no. What they are doing is furthering their ideological views. So So they didn't apply it to pregnancy centers. Doesn't mean that the other side isn't going to try to see that happen again or to try to make that happen. But for now, they don't. But a few intermediate federal courts, so the federal courts of appeal, so while the Supreme Court has not applied this doctrine, the Ninth Circuit, which covers California, Arizona, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, and Guam. And the Third Circuit, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and the Virgin Islands, has kind of waded in to applying this professional speech doctrine in broader context. So it's something we're watching. But for now, the Supreme Court has not extended it to the work of pregnancy centers and professionals that work within these centers. So does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. In addition to the right of free speech, the First Amendment protects the right of free association, including expressive association. The First Amendment recognizes a right to peacefully assemble and to engage in freedom of speech, what we call the right of expressive association. It protects the right to associate with others in advance of common beliefs and ideas. It protects your ability to operate as a pro-life organization, people sharing beliefs and common values coming together to advance a common mission. Generally, the government cannot force you to associate with others that do not share your values, beliefs, or mission, or force you to hire people that don't agree with that mission or those beliefs. As the Supreme Court said in 1958, effective advocacy of both public and private points of view, particularly controversial ones, is undeniably enhanced by group association, as this court has more than once recognized by remarking upon the close nexus between freedom of speech and assembly. And where we're seeing this kind of come in with pregnancy centers is the last point I mentioned, where they're trying to make perhaps you hire people who don't agree with your missions or beliefs. We've seen it in a number of states where bills have come out and said you can't discriminate against someone based on their views on quote unquote reproductive rights or reproductive freedom. And what we're concerned about is that becomes a sneaky way to say that pro-life organizations have to hire people who support abortion or advocate for abortion. So we talked about freedom of speech, freedom of association, those important First Amendment rights. Now we're going to talk about the free exercise of religion, which is also implicated by the work done most often by pregnancy centers. A religious nonprofit has further protections under the First Amendment, which recognizes both free exercise of religion and protection under the Establishment Clause. The additional protections afforded to religious nonprofits, when employed properly, will allow a nonprofit to organize and to hire and fire according to its own beliefs and to operate its business in accordance with those beliefs, and will also provide a shield against various demands that are made under anti-discrimination and public accommodation laws. So when I went over and talked about the First Amendment, that's going to apply very strongly whether you're a general nonprofit or a religious nonprofit. What I'm talking about now is going to be more protections that are provided when a center is organized as a religious nonprofit. The Free Exercise Clause guarantees the right to exercise your religion without interference from the government. The right to free exercise of religion is implicated in laws that regulate medical professionals, doctors, nurses, and others, to provide and refer for services that go against their deeply held religious beliefs. If you operate as a religious organization as a pregnancy center, your center would also derive additional rights under the Free Exercise Clause, which would allow you to maintain standards of conduct and require adherence to specific religious beliefs. Burdens on religiously motivated conduct are subject to strict scrutiny under the Free Exercise Clause when the regulation lacks neutrality or general applicability. So if a state enacts a law saying pregnancy centers or pro-life professionals cannot fill in the blank, whatever they decide to do, that is not a generally applicable law, is it? It's being targeted. And it may be targeted, for example, let's say you have a conscience law in your state that says that a medical professional is not required to participate in, refer for, or counsel in favor of abortion. And thankfully, a lot of states have those laws right now. But let's say a state tried to enact the converse and said every medical professional, when a woman comes in and she has a diagnosed pregnancy, will discuss, quote unquote, all of her options, including abortion. That puts the medical professional, the pro-life medical professional, in a very difficult situation. But you'll notice that law didn't say that it applies to abortion clinic workers or other people who are dealing with pregnant women. So that is not a neutral law. That is a targeted law. And the courts look upon those with great disfavor. Recently, the Supreme Court issued a very important free exercise decision called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. And that dealt with Christian Catholic adoption agencies and their work. It says that the government fails to act neutrally when it proceeds in a manner intolerant of religious beliefs or restricts practices because of their religious nature. Doesn't mean that these state and local governments aren't trying, but thankfully the Supreme Court so far is holding the dam. The Establishment Clause forbids government from dictating religious practices, so they can't tell you as a religious follower how to practice your faith. It can't look at your religious beliefs and how you practice and say, well, that's a legitimate belief, that's a legitimate practice, this is not. That's not the business of government. When we hear about the Establishment Clause these days, we usually hear about it in the context of forbidding religion to interfere with the government, right? We hear that phrase, the wall of separation of church and state. But actually, one of the primary purposes of the Establishment Clause was for the reverse, to prohibit the government from interfering with the church and with religion. This is evident from the history of when the Constitution was ratified, because as we all know from history, Britain had a long history of repressing religious people when they didn't agree with the crown. British royalty famously switched religions between Catholicism and the Anglican Church, and to this day runs its own church. That's what the Establishment Clause was seeking to forbid here in the United States. Our founders sought to stop the problems that stemmed from the government being in charge of religion, and that's how we ended up with the Establishment Clause. In a case, and I'm going to read this long quote, so you're going to have to forgive me, but again, these quotes from the Supreme Court are gold on these issues. In a case that held that it was acceptable that a state fund busing to parochial schools as part of a general program. So it had a general program that was funding busing, but they were saying we're not going to, so this general program that funded busing would do it to public schools and to parochial schools. And they were sued saying you're violating the Establishment Clause by basically taxpayer dollars funding busing to parochial schools. And when the court said, no, that's not the case, this is what it said. The Establishment of Religion Clause of the First Amendment means at least this. Neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. Neither can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion over another. Neither can force nor influence a person to go to or to remain away from church against his will, or force him to profess a belief or disbelief in any religion. No person can be punished for entertaining or professing religious beliefs or disbeliefs, for church attendance or non-attendance. No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion. So again, the importance was to teach or practice religion. So somebody might say, well, you're saying you can't use tax money for religious purposes. In the case of busing, it was just to get the kids to school. It wasn't, the money wasn't specifically targeted to propagate religious beliefs. That's what the court doesn't want to see. Neither a state nor a federal government can openly or secretly participate in the affairs of any religious organization or groups, and vice versa. In the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. The First Amendment requires the state to be neutral in its relation with groups of religious believers and non-believers. It does not require the state to be their adversary. State power is no more to be used so as to handicap religion as to favor it. So what the court was saying was that the Establishment Clause, you want the government to be neutral on issues of religion. Don't favor religion, don't disfavor religion. Don't become certainly the enemy of religion. And unfortunately, too often we're seeing the pendulum kind of go to the disfavor side. And that's because of the distortion, as you all know, of what Jefferson said in his letter to the Danbury Baptist. That letter was to keep the government out of the church's affairs, not the other way around. So does that make sense, the Establishment Clause? Okay, you guys can all go to law school now. So let's talk a little bit about the threats. And I'm sure you guys are well aware of many of these. We'll start with anti-discrimination laws. Local cities, counties, and states have passed non-discrimination laws which elevate categories such as sexual orientation and gender identity to protected status. One at the federal level that we were hearing a lot more about earlier this year than lately is the Equality Act. It's been reintroduced in Congress multiple times, and the essence of it is that it adds sexual orientation and gender identity to protected classes that already exist in federal anti-discrimination laws, like race, sex, disability. It would prohibit employers, preschools, and even religious schools and organizations from making choices based on basic biology, bodily privacy, and their beliefs about the nature of marriage. It would apply to every single recipient of federal financial assistance, which generally means every public school and most colleges and universities. It would have an enormous impact on any entity receiving federal funding. It could even be read to forbid churches and religious nonprofits, including pregnancy centers, from requiring their employees to adhere to the organization's religious beliefs about marriage, sexual morality, and the distinction between the sexes. These groups could be required to open their sex-specific facilities to members of the opposite sex, so bathrooms, locker rooms. But remember, there has to be some sort of triggering law for this federal law to apply. Not every pregnancy center would have to apply, or not every pregnancy center currently has to comply, for example, with Title VII. Title VII's an anti-discrimination provisions because you don't employ enough people. Title VII applies to organizations employing 15 or more. But there are some ways that a pregnancy center or other religious organization might be subject to the provisions of the Equality Act. They have written this in such a way that it makes it incredibly difficult for organizations, for businesses to not fall under the Equality Act. One way they've done that is it offers no protections for religious freedom. The law, as it's written, specifically says that religious individuals and organizations cannot invoke the federal law, if you've heard of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that you cannot invoke that as a defense if you're charged with discrimination under the Equality Act. So it would make it harder for people of faith to defend themselves against a bill that's essentially designed to punish them for living out their beliefs. So the idea, yes, ma'am.
So are you saying that this could be a threat that comes against us if
yes.
this Equality Act is enforced?
Is that it is. Okay. I'm saying there are a bunch of different ways that it could apply.
So what did you mean?
If you say you employ more than 15 people,
okay.
under you're subject to Title VII, the federal law Title VII.
Okay.
So they're changing Title VII to add sexual orientation and gender identity as a protected class. So that's one way they could get you, if you employ enough people.
Okay.
But another way they could get you is more generally saying if someone comes in, asks for services, you say deny them services for whatever reason, or can't, or don't hire them or something, and they say you did it because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity, under the law, the way it's written, if it passes as it's written, and gosh, we hope it doesn't, obviously, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act doesn't apply. You can't invoke that federal protection for your right to religious expression as a defense.
But my mission statement clearly says between man and woman.
I know. But this basically is going to say it doesn't matter. They don't care.
So that needs to be struck out. That particular thing.
So I take it out of my mission statement?
No. That's not what I'm telling you.
No, you absolutely do not.
What I'm telling you is the fact that you are organized that way may not protect you under the Equality Act. I'm not telling you to change anything. In fact, I will encourage you a little while later to make your protections even stronger.
And remember, these are threats. These are not. This hasn't passed.
This hasn't happened.
But we have to pray it doesn't.
But this is currently sitting in Congress, and there has been discussion about, can we take out that provision with regard to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act? The other side is never going to allow that because it doesn't get them what they want. Because if you're allowed to invoke your religious beliefs, what's changed from their perspective? But thankfully, the bill is going nowhere. There are things right now that have focus over the Equality Act. For a while, there was a lot of discussion earlier this year about the Equality Act, and that has kind of dissipated. Yes?
So how would that apply as far as gender identity? If someone identifies as one gender but are biologically another, would we have to refer to them as, like if a woman comes in who identifies as a man, would we have to refer to that person as?
They would argue if you don't, you're discriminating against them.
Even if we serve and...
Okay. I would be concerned that if you used the wrong pronouns or didn't, you know, if it was a biological male, if you didn't treat him as if he were a biological female, you could run into problems the way discrimination laws are written.
Did you say another way besides, like, the Title VII was... You said something about federal... Funds?
Oh, the way the federal law applies is usually people are recipients of federal funding.
Right.
So let's say in order for you to get this pot of federal money, right. you have to comply with this particular law. That may not apply to you, but think about it. My daughter goes to a faithfully Catholic college who accepts federal money in terms of student loans. They would be on the hook under the Equality Act because they are accepting federal money, so the government has a right to say, here are the strings that we attach to that money.
So my board and I have been discussing the protection of not taking federal funds, but when you look at state funds, such as A2A, it's from federal money, a TANF dollar, so that loophole...
It could. I mean, it would depend on what finally passed.
Sure.
You would have to look very carefully at all the tentacles. As you know, the federal tentacles are everywhere.
Yeah.
But this is a huge threat if it passes. And I don't think I need to tell you guys that. I did a whole presentation earlier this year, an hour and a half, talking about the potential dangers of the Equality Act and just how much of our daily lives it would disrupt and our ability to live our faith peacefully in the public square. But that's by design.
Is there never, there have been some teachers, coaches, et cetera, who stood up and said, I will not call you a boy when you're a girl or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they win and then it goes back and, you know.
Well, it depends where they are because, we're talking about a broad federal law. Mm-hmm. Some states and local governments have basically enacted something like this already. So depending on where they are, they could be subject to these types of draconian restrictions.
So I guess my question was, is there never a time for a Christian to stand and say?
Of course. Of course.
And when is that time?
I think it's now.
Okay. I was just curious because of the way you answered Becky's question about if you don't say that's a male when she comes into your center.
I'm just talking about the threats.
Okay.
I'm not saying you don't live according to your beliefs. Obviously, I am someone in great support of living according to your beliefs, but you have to understand what the threat means.
And so are there states that are now enacting some preventive measures against these kinds of things? Would there, you talked about state protections a little earlier. Would there be state protections that...
They're doing it a little more piecemeal. You know, in certain situations where we're seeing this rearing its head now already, like women's sports. You've heard about Save Women's Sports bills. So it's kind of been a piecemeal approach because we would argue that our Constitution, federal and state, already protect us here. I mean, that's the right answer.
But are we living in a post-constitutional
America? I hope not. I hope not. Okay, one more question than I really...
Oh, sorry. My thing is, so if someone comes into your center, I think the first thing to do is to love that person. And if they want to be called that, then call them that day. You know, and as you build a relationship, and as all that kind of stuff, because they're looking to you for something. You know, and I just think it's important to just, kind of like that VTay video last night, can somebody just love me where I'm at? And then, you know what I'm saying? No telling what can happen because of that. As you speak truth and as you love, there's some stuff going on in their minds anyway that they need some help with. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily say I've got the right to say that. I just love that person.
A lot of what I'm hoping to do is just, in this particular section of the presentation, is just highlight what I know a lot of you already know is going on, but so that you understand the problem so you can make prudent decisions for your centers on what you're going to do and how you're going to grapple with it. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that even at the end of this. As you know, the Supreme Court recently held that Title VII's protections on discrimination on the basis of sex, so the word sex, extended to gender identity and sexual orientation in two cases that came out last year. But it was very careful to say that it was not making any determinations as regard to religious organizations. So the organizations involved in that litigation were companies, you know, for-profit type companies, not religious organizations. But they were certainly people who ran those organizations who had deeply held beliefs that are being violated. And that was the Bostock case. Another threat is we're often seeing at the state and local level is pregnancy center regulations. And the most common type we're seeing are disclosure laws that a number of states have passed that aim at requiring pregnancy centers to deliver certain information about abortion or birth control. We talked about the one in California that was thankfully struck down in NIFLA, but they're still trying. They're trying to find a way around what NIFLA had to say. But because the California law, the Reproductive Fact Act, started all this, let me just tell you a little bit more in detail about what that law did. It required medical pregnancy centers to post information about state-sponsored services, including abortion. Non-medical centers had to post a disclaimer as well that they were not a licensed medical facility. And this was required to be in very large font, in multiple languages, in many places. One of the best things that the Supreme Court looked at in the amicus briefs that were filed in that case was somebody actually produced an ad and said, if you make me comply with this law, this is what my ad has to look like. And the court actually, during oral arguments, pointed to that and said, is this what you're requiring? Because, for example, the costs to the center to post this ad were astronomical. You know, even if you just had a small little ad that said, we love life, you would have to support, you would have to put this disclaimer, we are not a medical center, and then put that in multiple languages if you wanted to place that ad somewhere. So obviously it was prohibitive. In Nifla versus Becerra, the Supreme Court held that this law likely violated the First Amendment. Since then, most compelled pregnancy center regulations have been invalidated or withdrawn, but they keep trying, and they will keep trying. Unfortunately, these types of laws have continued in slightly different forms. Illinois currently has a law that compels pregnancy centers and pro-life medical professionals to talk about the benefits of abortion with every patient and present it as a treatment option. So, and to provide referral information to a doctor that provides abortion if asked. That law is currently on the books, but ADF has sued to overturn it. So the litigation continues. Connecticut just passed a law regulating pregnancy centers, and they kind of do it under the umbrella of what they call deceptive advertising. And the law only applies to places that do not perform or refer for abortion, and bans quote-unquote deceptive advertising. Well, remember what I told you about viewpoint discrimination. It doesn't apply to abortion clinics, for example. This law is very broad in its language, leaving a lot of discretion to the government. For example, an omission could lead to an ad being called misleading. So if you put out a pro-life ad talking about the benefits to women of keeping their children or the beauty of adoption, don't talk about abortion, that's an omission that may lead the state to say you engaged in deceptive advertising. We are all well aware that pregnancy centers have been attacked in the past for being quote unquote misleading because they don't provide information about abortion. This Connecticut law does not have a compelled speech component. It doesn't say you have to say certain things. But if the state finds that you've engaged in deceptive speech, the attorney general can order them to engage in corrective speech, which means, okay, you need to change that ad. You need to change that ad to say this. That we're worried that this particular strategy might gain steam because it's one of the newer ways they're trying to get around NIFLA. But we have sued them to try and get this one struck down as well. But you need to be on the lookout here in your state. I'm not as concerned here, but that there could be bills introduced that get legs that talk about things like deceptive advertising and are targeted toward pregnancy centers. So it's just a good idea to be on the lookout for that, both at the state and the local levels. Yes, ma'am.
When you say corrective speech, mm-hmm. is that mandating that you go back and redo that? Mm-hmm. Or is it acceptable to simply say we're not going to run that ad anymore?
No, well, the way we read the law, again, it's written very broadly, so it's open to interpretation. But the way we read it, it would force you to go back and reissue it, not just pull it.
Would they have to pay for that again?
Yeah. So we talked about these disclosure laws, and you have reproductive health non-discrimination laws. DC and New York have enacted laws that prohibit discrimination in hiring based on reproductive views. This is an emerging issue, emerging trend, and these laws have been increasing since the NIFLA decision. They would not allow employers to take into account reproductive decisions in employment. These laws may make it difficult for a pregnancy center to hire and fire in accordance with their beliefs about abortion and are a great threat to the pro-life community. These laws continue to be proposed each legislative session, and they're again something important to look out for because they're a threat to expressive association. You don't want to be a pro-life pregnancy center and have the state try and force you to hire someone who advocates for abortion. But that is exactly what these laws potentially open up the door to. And then prohibitions on religious codes of conduct. Some states have attempted to make it illegal to hire in accordance with a statement of faith requiring adherence to religious conduct. In 2007, California attempted such a law. Surprisingly, it was vetoed by the governor. And Delaware has also done it recently. So these are proposals that are being made. Thankfully, they have not gotten a lot of traction, but they are something to be on the lookout for because it only takes one to actually be enacted to cause significant problems.
But then also Planned Parenthood would have to hire someone who was pro-life.
Assuming, presuming.
It would be rough. You'd be
well, but they're not, well, you gotta remember, they're not a religious organization. They don't operate according to a religious code of conduct.
Okay, so that's what
they don't have a statement of faith, and like a lot of places, pregnancy centers do. ADF does. We have a statement of faith that we follow. We agree to certain codes of conduct as Christians. Planned Parenthood doesn't have that. Correct. Okay, let's talk real quickly about federal laws that apply and may implicate religious liberty. First, employment discrimination protections. We've been talking around that a little bit with the Equality Act and other things. They extend to federal anti-discrimination laws in employment extend to every aspect of employment, hiring, promotion, termination, and everything in between. The most well-known protection is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which you'll hear me talk about is just Title VII. And that prohibits employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national orientation. And as we heard, in some cases, the Supreme Court has extended it to gender identity and sexual orientation for certain businesses. And the Equality Act would expand it to absolutely encompass gender identity and sexual orientation. There is the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, which prohibits discrimination against individuals who are age 40 or over. The Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination in employment on the basis of disability. Now, you heard me mention before when we were talking about Title VII that it applies in specific circumstances. It applies to organizations who have 15 employees who have worked a regular work week for 20 weeks in a calendar year. Don't you love how they write federal law? And volunteers, though, are generally not considered employees under Title VII. Perhaps the most important federal protection in the pregnancy center context is religious. Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of religion. However, there is an exception for religious organizations. And that is why it's important oftentimes for people to actually operate formally as a religious organization. And this is known as the religious organizations exception. Organizations that qualify for the exemption are essentially free to limit their employment to people who share their religious belief and missions. And to end employment for those who don't, not offer or end employment for those who do not share your beliefs and mission. Religious corporations, associations, institutions, and societies are permitted to give preference to people of their faith. This means that a Christian pregnancy center organized as a religious corporation or a religious nonprofit may choose to hire only those in alignment with the corporate religious beliefs and mission. Does that make sense?
Even though they're in a position that is non-client
yes.
related or
I think what you're getting at is there's this exception called the ministerial exception. And there's been a lot of litigation over what that means and who that extends to. But we still advocate for pregnancy centers to consider organizing themselves as religious nonprofits to give you as much protection as possible and to give you those arguments to argue that you are a religious organization, therefore you shouldn't, under free exercise, free association, you should be able to associate and hire and fire according to your beliefs.
Well, one of the things that a few years ago we were encouraged to put in everybody's job description is that they will engage in backup or somehow of like, you know, working with the clients, mm-hmm. even though they're just simply data input, you know, because that way, you know, it was a caveat that said because they didn't deal with our clientele, then mm-hmm. they didn't have to fall into that.
Yeah. So we're done at 10, right?
Quarter till,
okay.
45,
all right. I've been giving you guys a law seminar mm-hmm. on what the law means, because I think it's important to understand the environment we work in. Why don't we skip to and talk to some practical things that you can do? So we want to make sure that we protect your expressive association, which is your ability to associate with people who share your beliefs, values, your mission, your faith. You will be protected to the greatest extent possible if you are incorporated as a religious nonprofit. And the way you can do that, or the way that the courts look at it, is they have these factors, the world vision factors, that the court will look at. Because there will be litigation, even if you do everything you can in some circumstances to write things into your mission statement and to organize how you run your daily operations around your faith to show that you're a religious organization. Oftentimes, unfortunately, you end up having to go into court to continue to allow yourself that freedom. So the court looks at four different factors. Was the organization organized for religious purposes? Again, how do we show that? In our mission statement. In all of our documents, in how we run our daily operations, and even how our center looks. Is there obviously a religious connection? Engage primarily in carrying out that religious purpose. Holds itself out to the public as an entity for carrying out that purpose. And does not engage primarily or substantially in the exchange of goods or services for money beyond nominal amounts. Am I in your way? So, the booklet I showed at the beginning has more information on this. But things you need to look at to make sure that the religious nature, if you're organized as a religious nonprofit, and that's a decision for you and your board to make. I've heard good arguments both ways for how people decide to organize. But if you want the most protection, I'm going to suggest that you consider, if you're not already, organizing as a religious nonprofit. And documents that you need to make sure that you have to help demonstrate that, yes, we are in fact a religious organization operating according to those principles. It needs to be in your mission statement. And that can be something as simple as make abortion unwanted. You know, our mission is to make abortion unwanted and unnecessary by providing life-affirming medical care and supportive counseling that is consistent with the biblical belief that all life is created in the image of God and is therefore sacred and irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be hard. It just has to be there. Having a statement of faith. A statement on the sanctity of life. Why do you believe life should be protected? And obviously that very often would include biblical scriptural principles. Statement on marriage and sexuality, given the fact that the threats we're often seeing are coming from people who want to see anti-discrimination laws enforced in cases involving sexual orientation and gender identity. A code of Christian conduct that your employees need to adhere to. Religious employment criteria. A statement of final authority on matters of faith and conduct. And what that basically is you're saying if there is a question that does somebody's conduct violate any of these codes, you appoint someone or some board or organization to be the final arbiter. It can be your, you know, chairman of your board, but you have to appoint someone to do that. And you have to maintain a religious character. Do you have any questions about any specific ones of those?
You said those are outlined in that book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's some examples and everything.
Okay.
So does that all make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Can anybody share any, does anybody want to share any ways that they're doing any of these things for the benefit of the others?
I think we had to change our statement to define marriage between one biological man and one biological person. This year we changed that.
Any other examples?
We have an employee handbook, not just our policy and procedures. So when somebody comes in and they're interested in volunteering, we're giving the employee handbook. And it has that in it so they know what they're going to do. You know, so they don't have to read the whole policy and procedure handbook. They have that. They can ask questions.
Right. Sure. I mean, the more ways that you incorporate it into your organizing documents and the way you structure your organization, the better. I mean, that's why I mentioned that we've even had suggested that people find ways to make the center's religiosity obvious when someone comes into your center. Whatever fits best for you. For some people, that would include religious beliefs on the, putting religious belief information or religious information on the website. It might be religious decor. It might be a prayer room. Having Bibles somewhere available in the center. There are bunches of ways that you can do this. It just adds evidence to the fact that you are a religious organization motivated by religious purpose. Because hopefully you never end up in litigation where you're arguing over whether you were allowed to make a certain decision according to your religious beliefs. But the hope here is that what we have can help you in the case that happens. You know, our client Jack Phillips, the cake baker from Colorado, is a good example of nothing else than some people are just going to be vindictive and they're going to come after you because they don't like what you believe. We'd like to think it doesn't happen. We would never think of doing such a thing to anyone else, but it happens. So do everything you can now to protect yourselves. And here's our complete library that if you don't have, I would suggest you get. We talked about the Protecting Your Pregnancy Center booklets. You can go to our website and download it online. If you would actually like hard copies, contact us and we'll get you some. We have a booklet more generally talking about faith in the workplace. In the practice of faith in the workplace. A legal guide for healthcare professionals, it talks about those conscience exemptions that I talked about. A lot of, obviously, centers have doctors or other medical professionals who come in and volunteer their time or work for the center, and they have certain protections in the law right now, thankfully. to protect their right to refuse to perform, refer for, or counsel in favor of abortion. But wouldn't surprise you that those laws are under vicious attack. 48 states have them. We actually have two states that do not independently protect medical conscience. I know. Kind of, do you want to take a guess?
California.
New York does. California does.
Illinois.
Nope. Illinois has narrowed their protections.
Colorado?
No, Colorado's good. It's in the Northeast.
Massachusetts?
New Hampshire and Vermont.
Well.
But up until 2 years ago, there was a third state, and I'm going to shock you when I tell you what that third state was that did not have independent protections for healthcare professionals. Alabama. Mm. Never would have thought it. So there are federal protections for healthcare professionals. There are state protections. But this provides them with information on how to structure their lives and how they practice so that they're protected. And then we also have a legal guide for sidewalk counselors. So they know what they can and cannot do, because they're often told, well, you can't do this and you can't be here and this is not protected by free speech. And that kind of refutes a lot of those arguments. So those are also available if you want them. I know I tried to throw an awful lot of information at you in a short period of time. We have a couple minutes for questions or comments or things you'd like to share with each other about protecting your center. 5 minutes.
Thank you so much for what you all do.
It is our pleasure.
You guys take on such huge cases, and they're lengthy, and I would just encourage everyone to pray for the Alliance Defending Freedom. You guys definitely are the David against the Goliath, and we just thank God for you.
Thank you. So forgive me for teaching law school for the first part of this, but it is our pleasure, and one of the key areas that we do focus in on is pregnancy centers. You know, obviously we took NIFL all the way to the Supreme Court, and I had the pleasure of being part of that team that worked on that case. And I, you know, I'm confident about what's going on in Illinois and Connecticut too, but I'm sorry that the centers there are subject to this and we have to go through this litigation. But the NIFLA case gave us the basis to, I think, successfully defend those cases. But just be on the lookout for those types of things. Sometimes they're coming out at the local level even more now, because a state won't pass it. So the local city council decides they're going to try and do it. That's what we're seeing in Virginia right now, in Kentucky, and other conservative states where the state legislature is not going to pass anything like this, but certain city councils decide, yeah, we'll do it. Do you have something?
Well, trying to think of how to say this. Hypothetically, if you had a medical director that was on ACOG, and ACOG is censoring what they can say, you know, because they're in a board position on ACOG. Mm-hmm. And I know she's reached out to ADF, but do you have any wisdom on it? Because it's an entirely different.
It
who
is.
Who regulates that? Who?
The problem we're running, the other problem we're running into with medical professionals is not only, you know, voluntary groups like ACOG. You know, they set standards for practice, but they don't have a lot of authority over individual physicians. But who does is a group called ABOG, which is the American Board of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. So they set the board certification standards. And what we're concerned about is they're working in concert with groups like ACOG and others who support abortion to say, well, if you won't refer for abortions, we're not going to certify you. We're not there yet, because there are federal laws that protect against making those types of determinations. But it's a messy area, so I'm glad she's reached out to ADF and is talking with our attorneys who can, you know, speak to her specific circumstances. But thank you for asking for prayers for ADF, but we need to pray for our pro-life medical professionals. The attacks they're facing are significant. Some of them may not be able to continue to practice.
Under the understanding that anybody can sue anybody for anything,
Darn lawyers.
had occasion to interface with a few. What would be your advice? Let's say that you're a clinic in some town, and all of a sudden you're notified that you are being sued for violation of Title VII or some related. What's the first thing? What initial actions should that clinic take to defend themselves? Understanding the cost of litigation.
Okay, call ADF immediately. Because if we can't help you, we're going to find an attorney who can help you, who has some experience in these areas. And I would just tell you generally things that attorneys always tell people. Don't talk about it till you've had a chance to talk to your attorney. Don't talk to anybody about it. You know, you get a summons or you get a complaint, get served with a complaint, don't talk about it till you've had a chance to confer with an attorney. Obviously, make sure that you keep all documents, computer, printed documents, everything in place. That you make a list of who might be have knowledge of this, that might be a potential witness, and just kind of gather all that information for your attorney. But my biggest advice is call us. Because we do this all the time.
We want to thank Denise. This is so important for us.